You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast. This is episode 54, and we are looking at the question, how do we know that Jesus really did rise from the dead? In other words, what evidence do we have? What meaning does it have for Christians today? And one of the things I think that we should look at, Jamie, is some of the evidences that have been brought forward against the resurrection, and just to consider those and think about why would these be coming forward, and what do we think about? So in light of that, let me just start by pointing out the importance of the resurrection. In 1 Corinthians 15:17, Paul the Apostle said, "If Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins." In other words, in Christianity, everything depends on the resurrection. If the resurrection is not true, then Christianity is not true. And it's important to see that when he uses that word resurrection in scripture, when that term is used, the Greek is the word anastasis. And anastasis has a specific meaning. It actually means physically getting up. It's like when you get up in the morning, when you get out of your bed, we would use that same term, anastasis. You're standing up. And in that sense, that's what's being talked about. It's not a resurrection merely in the spiritual sense, or, you know, Jesus lives on, you know, in my heart. People will sometimes put it in that sense. But really, what we're talking about is a historical event that actually happened, that Jesus bodily and physically got up and left the tomb. So first, maybe just anecdotally, Jamie, what are some objections that you have heard to the truth of the resurrection, or maybe some actual news reports?
Yeah, I think the biggest, at least most common argument for that position that Jesus was not resurrected, I think largely centers around the fact that the vast majority of the arguments in favor of Jesus' resurrection come from a biblical context. Now, you know, we go to 1 Corinthians 15, of course we do, because that's the most, I think, most important argument for Jesus' resurrection, because Paul does several different things in there. I mean, first of all, he presents what I'd call the historic argument for the resurrection of Jesus, and then he moves on to the logical argument for his resurrection, then a theological argument, and then ends with more of an experiential argument. And so there's a degree to which we'd say, well, yes, we do argue from the Bible, and to a degree, is that biased? Well, yeah, in a sense. However, when you really look at the argument being presented, then, you know, and we'll get into that later on in this podcast, but it's there that you see it actually is much more broad than just a biblical argument, certainly. And then at the same time, we also recognize there is a lot of historic truth to the resurrection of Jesus, and certainly there's even, you could argue, more empirical evidence as well, you know, to that end. I'd say that's the most common argument for the fact that Jesus' resurrection never happened, and certainly there are some, I mean, even people who claim to be Christians, I've run across a few here and there, that actually don't believe Jesus was resurrected as well. And of course, you know, you and I in a logical sense would say, then you're not saved. I mean, you cannot believe that Jesus was not resurrected and be saved. Certainly, as you pointed out, I mean, Paul even argues, if the resurrection never happened, then we're to be pitied more than anybody else. And that's very true. In fact, the entire, you know, there are certain linchpins in the Christian faith that without them, the whole rest falls apart. An example of that would be the reality of God being Trinitarian nature. You know, one God yet manifest in three persons. Without that being true, then the Christian faith falls apart. And the same is true with Jesus being fully God and fully man, I believe. Without that, again, our faith falls apart, and most vitally of all those things is the question of resurrection. If Jesus had not been resurrected, then you and I are probably two of the dumbest people on the planet, let alone, you know, millions of others.
Right. Well, then that's the interesting thing about that argument is Paul puts Christians in a sense, he puts them in a precarious position, you could say, because in no other religion do you have the entire truth of that faith system based on the belief of a single historical event like that. Now, you could argue, well, wasn't that true for Muhammad receiving the Quran and other folks receiving parts of their text? But again, even there, Muhammad isn't he's the one who just receives the message from Allah, according to Islam. It's not as though his place in the story makes Islam true. He's just conveying the message that, according to the Quran, is already true. But one example, Jamie, that I think of, that this was back in 2007, so it's not a, you know, yesterday's news sort of thing, but there was a 2007 documentary called The Jesus Family Tomb, put together by Simca Jacobovici, and it was in partnership with James Cameron, who probably most of you would recognize as the director of Avatar. Anyway, what happened in this film, The Jesus Family Tomb, is the archaeologists and the filmmakers show them coming across a tomb in Israel that gives names like Mary, Joseph, John, and then there's one that's named Jesus or Yeshua. And the claim was, okay, here we have clear evidence that this is the tomb of Jesus' family, and these are the bones, in fact, of Jesus. Side note, that was totally debunked because much more credible historians and scholars who looked at this said things like the possibility of this being Jesus' family is very close to zero. Number one, because Joseph, Mary, and John, especially, were all very common names. And Jesus, in fact, had a very common name at the time. You know, Jesus would be the same name, basically, as Joshua. So a lot of people would name him after the great hero from the Old Testament. They said there was many other problems with the theory, such as the fact that there's no evidence that the Mary in this tomb was the mother of the Jesus. You know, it could have been a totally different combination. And just the fact of finding this tomb, which had many more bodies besides, you know, just Jesus, Joseph, and Mary's names, there were many other names included. They really said it was absolutely there's no reason to think this is Jesus of Nazareth's family. But beyond that, what I found really sad, actually, was the fact that many liberal Christians responded to this documentary by saying, well, even if they are Jesus's bones, that wouldn't change my faith at all. My faith is something deeper than bones in a tomb or something along those lines. And I think what they were trying to do is they were trying to sound very strong in their faith, very spiritual, but what they were actually doing is undermining the historicity of Christ's resurrection. They were saying, essentially, that's a second-tier issue. Whether it's true that Jesus actually rose from the dead is less important than how I feel about Jesus. And Paul, as we've just read and pointed out, Jamie made this point too, that if we actually hold to Christianity, then we've got to hold to the whole thing. It really does stand and fall as one entire piece. If you don't have the resurrection, then you don't have a faith. So that's why we want to look at the evidence, because this is something, especially in light of it being Easter Sunday coming up, we want to be able to say, look, not only do we have these amazing, heartfelt, joyful feelings because we know and believe Jesus is risen from the dead, but we actually have really good evidence for that faith.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's also worth noting, you know, when you're talking about liberal theology, to a good swath of those in the vein of liberal theology we have today, To many of them, Jesus was not God. Jesus was not divine at all. And so in terms of that belief, you know, if Jesus is just a really good example of a godly man, maybe the most godly man, if that's true of you, then it probably doesn't matter at that point, you know, if Jesus was really resurrected or not. And I would definitely, I mean, I would begin this conversation really with the historic argument that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 15. So, you know, we'd go to the beginning of the passage where it says, you know, he starts out the 1 Corinthians 15 by saying, "Now, brothers, I want to clarify for you the gospel I proclaimed to you. You received it and have taken your stand on it. You also were saved by it. If you hold to the message I proclaimed to you, unless you believe for no purpose, for I passed on to you what was most important when I also, or what I also received, what Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, then he also appeared to over 500 brothers at one time. Most of them are still alive, but some have fallen asleep. Then he also appeared to James, then to the apostles. Last of all, as to one abnormally born, he also appeared to me." You can read that and think, okay, so he's just making a case for, hey, you know, Jesus was seen by all these people. But what's really interesting is he specifically points out in there, he says, okay, first of all, Peter. So he appeared to Peter, and then he appeared to 500 folks. So there's that. Then who does he appear to? He appears to James and to Jesus' brothers. Now, James is one of Jesus' brothers, but both are true. And then, of course, last of all, he presents himself, Paul, as he builds this argument. So you sit and you look at this. Okay, so what really sticks out to me is, okay, the significance of 500 is to say there's a big group of people that saw Jesus, that interacted with Jesus. And those people, of course, go on to speak about the resurrection of Jesus in terms of historicity, in the sense that, you know, history is just the account, first person account of what was seen, what was experienced, how events went down. So he's presenting, okay, here's 500 people. They literally saw Jesus, they literally interacted with Jesus, and then of course they went on to talk about it, to share about it, and it's become a part of historic record. In fact, many of those people would actually go to their death proclaiming the truth of Jesus. So, okay, so that's the 500. But to me, the compelling case is with these other four. So he presents to us, Peter, he presents to us James. He presents to us the brothers of Jesus. We'll say Jude, because Jude is the only other brother of Jesus that really speaks a lot about this, at least that we have a historic record of. And then, of course, Paul. And so you go, okay, why would he choose those four? I think the reason he's chosen those four is because those four are the greatest argument for the resurrection of Jesus. What do I mean by that? Well, Peter had denied Jesus and, in a sense, had really given up on Jesus in terms of his resurrection. And even after receiving news of the resurrection of Jesus, it doesn't really appear that Peter really gets it, or at least believes it fully, you know, because we find him back fishing again. You know, he's gone back in a sense to his old way of life, really thinking the story of Jesus is over, the work of Jesus is over, the call of that message, the preaching the coming kingdom was all over. And so in that sense, you know, he's a great witness as well, because he in a sense had given up on Jesus, and then here he is now proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus to the point of his death. And then he presents, you know, James and Jude, the brothers of Jesus. And I think the reason Paul presents them is because they did not believe that Jesus was Messiah. They did not believe that Jesus was who he said he was, that he did what he said he would do. Now, how do we know that? Well, I would point you to Mark chapter 3, where we have this little bit of account. It says, beginning in verse 20, "Then he," being Jesus, "went home, and a crowd gathered again so that they went, so that they were not able to eat. When his family heard this, they set out to restrain him because they said, 'He is out of his mind.'" Now, this is Jesus' family. This is his brothers. This is maybe his mom. This is maybe his dad. Here they are trying to deal with Jesus because they think Jesus has lost his mind. He's literally gone crazy. He's proclaiming himself to be the Son of God. He's proclaiming himself to be the Messiah. He's, in a sense, proving that through miracles and all these sort of things. But still, they're not buying it. And again, we see this same kind of thing in John chapter 7. It says, "After this, Jesus traveled to Galilee, since he did not want to travel to Judea because the Jews were trying to kill him. The Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near. So his brothers said to him, 'Leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples can see your works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he's seeking public recognition. If you do these things, show yourself to the world.' For not even his brothers believed him." What's really interesting to me, Jason, is that they go on not believing in Jesus all the way along, even to, like, in the case of the book of John, you know, the book sort of builds to a climax, which is really a fake out, right? It's the raising of Lazarus, where Jesus declares himself to be the resurrection and the life. And what's unique in this story is that Lazarus was dead. I mean, he was 4 days dead. In all the other cases where Jesus had raised somebody from the dead, they had just died or had died within, you know, hours. And the case could be argued, you know, maybe they weren't really dead. Maybe they were just almost dead, to use the Princess Bride analogy there, but not actually dead. Well, Lazarus was dead, yet Jesus brought him back to life, and he declares himself to be the resurrection and the life. He has the power over life and death itself. Even that did not change Jesus' brother's opinion of him.
I want to piggyback on that, because I think what you said about James is really, it is a powerful case for the resurrection, because we all know, or at least we should admit, that we all have biases. I've got a bias. Jamie, you've got a bias. If you're watching this, you have a listening to this, you have a bias. And those are super hard to overcome. If you believe, for instance, that this material world is all there is, you might call yourself a skeptic even, then it would take an incredible amount of evidence. Maybe there could never be enough evidence to ever convince you of a miracle. In fact, a guy from the 18th century, you may have heard of, David Hume, said that a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. Now, when you think about James being Jesus's brother, I think that very likely he had a similar position to David Hume. Not in the sense that he never believed in miracles, but he just simply was biased against Jesus performing miracles. It's his own brother. You can imagine just being in a family where one of your siblings is claiming to be the Messiah, your Lord, your King, who you're going to bow down to. That would be really hard to accept. And that's exactly what Jesus was claiming, especially in the long term. The more he made claims about himself, he was identifying himself with God, in fact. But some people will come to the evidence of the resurrection and say, yeah, you know, it could be that there's this story laid down in scripture. There might even be a guy who claimed that there were 500 eyewitnesses. But from a skeptic's perspective, they might say things like, yeah, but you know what? That was written 2,000 years ago. And frankly, if we're going to be good historians, Bart Ehrman will say this, if we're going to be good historians, we need to err on the side of being suspicious of the miraculous rather than just openly buying without question. Jamie and I know we both actually agree. We don't want to just take whatever claim is out there without examining the evidence, but something to consider. J. Werner Wallace is a cold case detective, and he will tell you, after examining the evidence for the resurrection, that it's not so different from a lot of cold case murders, in fact, that are, he was a cold case homicide detective. It's not so different from those where you have basically the evidence of eyewitness testimony and then additional corroborating evidence. But the main thing you go off of when you solve those cold case murder cases, in other words, a cold case is something that they were never able to find the culprit. It's kind of been sitting for a long time. They were never able to resolve it. Well, the way they have, in the end, identified the murderer isn't usually because of DNA evidence. It's not usually because of something being found under a microscope. J. Werner Wallace will tell you it's actually based almost always on eyewitness testimony. Now, take that for a second and think about this. They are actually able to identify a murderer as guilty based on eyewitness testimony. So eyewitness testimony is a really powerful evidence, and we don't want to just discard it simply because it's 2,000 years old. That would be kind of arbitrary because it would be like, okay, you know, if it was 200 years ago, is it any less reliable? You know, the fact that George Washington crossed the Delaware River, is that any less believable just because it was more recent? It's still based on eyewitness testimony.
Mm-hmm. And in this case,
that's what we want to investigate next.
In this case, we're looking at, so we have, we've established James and Jude, not a fan of Jesus, certainly don't believe him to be Messiah, definitely believe him to be crazy. I mean, that's what they say. Literally, they go to restrain him, like, we got to protect people from him. That's pretty dramatic. To then, you know, James, who's also one of the biblical authors, begins his biblical narrative where he says, James, a slave of God and of who? The Lord Jesus Christ. Like, okay, that's a dramatic shift from, hey, he's crazy. Hey, we need to restrain him. The same sort of thing is true when it comes to Jude. So also a biblical author, also a brother of Jesus. His book begins with Jude, a slave of Jesus Christ and a brother of James. So both these guys have gone from Jesus is crazy, Jesus is dangerous, we don't believe him. In fact, it really, like in John chapter 7, it appears to me that they're actually mocking him. Like they're literally making fun of Jesus being Messiah. Like, oh yeah, go to Judea and prove it. You know, don't waste your talent on, you know, if you're trying to gain a following, if you're trying to become famous, if you're trying to, you know, get a book deal. This is not the way to do it, so go do it. And the stated reason is because they do not believe, to then declaring themselves to be slaves of Jesus, servants of Jesus, believers in Jesus. And in fact, both of those men go to their death proclaiming the truth of the resurrection of Jesus, the truth of the message of the gospel. And here's the thing. People die for a lie. That's a true statement. People die for a lie. However, people do not die if they know it's a lie. Okay, so you can convince somebody that something is true when it's not, but what you cannot do is convince somebody to go to their death for a lie. And Jude and James are two guys who were very much not believers in Jesus, were not his followers, were not his homies or his groupies, who were not on that line of thinking at all, and yet both of them ultimately go to their death proclaiming the truth that Jesus was not only resurrected, but he is the Messiah, and therefore the gospel proclaimed is absolutely true. And Paul presents this to us in 1 Corinthians 15 by saying, this is why they saw Jesus die they saw Jesus remain dead for 3 days, and then they saw, interacted with the resurrected Jesus, and therein lies the change. And then, of course, then Paul goes on to present himself. Jason, why is Paul a compelling evidence for the resurrection of Jesus?
Well, again, we look at the issue of bias. For someone's bias and presupposition to suddenly go from viewing Jesus as he did as a fake, as a false Messiah, Paul was out to destroy Christianity. That was his mission in life. To go from that to suddenly all you want to do is share the news that Jesus has risen from the grave, something radical has to happen. It's just a fact of history. People don't change their minds over these kind of dramatic worldview kind of things on a whim. Usually there's a gradual change, a gradual shift. But if you have something remarkable like this, then it's got to be something remarkable that happened. So let me go ahead and start with some of the things that Paul said. First of all, he claims Jesus died. Now, this is one of those things that's basically undisputed. Even like guys like John Dominic Crossan, who's a very liberal theologian, will tell you, yeah, it's indisputable. Jesus died. And one of the evidences we have for that is, we'll come back to Paul, but that John gave was that he actually saw Jesus on the cross. He was actually there when he was killed. And it says that in John 19, but when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and at once there came out blood and water. Now, obviously, John is not a medical expert. He's a fisherman. He's not going to know what he's seeing. He's just describing eyewitness testimony in the first century. And again, this is a powerful thing. It's persuaded judges that someone deserves death, eyewitness testimony. But in this case, it's a remarkable thing that he records this, because it's actually something known as pericardial effusion. When someone dies, there's heart failure, and the result is that there's this fluid that collects in the membrane around the heart. It's called pericardial effusion, and it's also around the lungs. So when you, when his heart is pierced, when his side is pierced, most likely it was his heart, seeing water come out, that's an indication that he had already died, that there already was heart failure. Now, John, when he records that, he has no idea that that's what he's seeing. He's just describing it because he was there. He's just recording the facts. But in the time, in the 2,000 years since then, we've learned why he saw that. And to me, I find that remarkable. But you bring up Paul. I think Paul, just the fact that, he was so hostile to Christianity. There's numerous times where he'll even say, I'm the one who was persecuting the church. I wanted to stamp it out. And yet he now is passionate about spreading the message of Jesus. And he'll tell you in the book of Acts, chapter 9, we have the account written by Luke that Paul was on his way to Damascus, and he was knocked off his high horse and came face to face with the risen Jesus. And that's the reason Paul will give for his dramatic change. Now, people could say, well, maybe he had a hallucination. Well, the problem with that theory is that the other people with him also heard the voice, though they didn't understand it. And there's the fact that Paul was blinded. You don't get blinded by a hallucination. Something actually happened to him. But more than that, there's the fact that there was this slow acceptance to receive Paul in the church because, they last thought of him as a persecutor. Even so, because of his dramatic change, they saw him as the one. They actually laid hands on him. In other words, they showed support of him and said, you are the one who will take the gospel to the Gentile nations. And so, and this is all recorded in the book of Acts. And to me, that's strong evidence that something dramatic must have happened. And really the only thing that you can make sense of is that Paul was just telling the truth. And it would only be a bias against the miraculous that would say, no, that can't be.
Yeah, and that's why I think, it's so easy to excuse, at least for those who don't necessarily believe the Bible. They look at 1 Corinthians 15 and they say, oh man, you know, of course the Bible is going to testify to the resurrection of Jesus. But I think what Paul is doing here in 1 Corinthians, at least in these first 11 verses, is he really is making an argument for historicity in the sense that he's presenting the best piece of evidence you can present, which is those who did not believe, who now believe and believe to the point of going to their death. If he had just said, oh yeah, the 500, all followers of Jesus and the apostles, they all testify to the same truth. It's very possible that they're under some spiritual delusion or just spiritual wishful thinking or a desire to have this, basically to not have their last 3 years of work wasted. I would admit, man, that's probably not terribly compelling from that perspective. However, the fact that he's presented to us really basically, you know, these four, and I would say all four are pretty compelling evidences, but especially these three who not only didn't believe in Jesus, but in Paul's case, like you said, were persecuting those who did believe in Jesus, and or in James and Jude's case, they believed him to be crazy. They didn't believe him to be true. You don't go from believing somebody's crazy to following them. I've met a few people in my life that I believe are crazy, and they've told me some really interesting things. You could call them prophecy. But the point is, you don't follow them. You know, you're like, oh, they're kind of nuts, or, you know, whatever. I even know somebody who testified to the return of Christ and a specific date, which happened to fall on a Sunday. This was a guy I went to church with back at, you know, at the time, and we joked about taking him out and stoning him because there was there was no return of Jesus. But you know, it's that kind of thing. When you think somebody's just nuts, you don't find yourself compelled to go to your death, or, you know, in Paul's case, where you're actively persecuting. I mean, you are so intensely against the teaching of Jesus, of his resurrection, of the gospel, that you're willing to kill people over it. You obviously don't turn around and start proclaiming that gospel. I mean, that doesn't just happen. Certainly isn't going to happen off of a lie. And so, yeah, this is still biblical truth in a sense. It is very historical. I don't know.
I know what you're saying. I mean, it's historical because number one, people will say, okay, the Gospels record this, but what is it? What do our extra biblical sources say? But again, there's built into that assumption that the gospel writers must have been making something up. When in fact, every time they talk about their intentions, it's always that they're saying, I want to convey the truth. Luke, the historian, begins his gospel by saying he went around collecting evidence. He interviewed eyewitnesses. He wanted to get at the truth. We have Peter saying, you know, we didn't follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. There's always that emphasis on, this is based on eyewitness testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your point, Jamie, about their willingness to die for this belief is huge because, if someone was lying about something, there's always going to be that risk-reward going on in their mindset. But why would you die over something you just knew was not true?
Mm-hmm.
There may have been like I could see how someone could imagine, you know, couldn't there be some kind of payoff? Like, I get to start my own religion if I come up with this idea that Jesus rose from the grave. I can see how some people could maybe manufacture some kind of motivation on a very limited level. But just listen to this. We have extra biblical evidence that Paul and Peter were martyred. Mm-hmm. So Tertullian wrote this. He said that Paul and Peter were martyred under Nero's regime, that Paul was beheaded and Peter crucified. And according to tradition, Peter was crucified upside down because he did not want to be killed in the same manner as his Lord. But this is what Tertullian wrote, and I quote, that Paul is beheaded has been written in their blood. And if a heretic wishes his confidence to rest upon a public record, the archives of the empire will speak as would the stones of Jerusalem. We read the lives of the Caesars. At Rome, Nero was the first who stained with blood the rising faith. Then it is Peter, girt by another, when is made fast to the cross. Then does Paul obtain a birth suited to Roman citizenship, when in Rome he springs to life again, ennobled by martyrdom. And again, we have other guys from the early church, like Origen, who said that the only reason that they were willing to go to their deaths, almost all the apostles were willing to go to their deaths, all of them, I should say, were willing. Not all of them were actually killed. But the only reason was because they were so thoroughly persuaded, Origen says, of Christ coming back from the dead. And so when you talk with people today who say, you know, I felt like I saw my dad alive after his funeral or something like that, that's not totally uncommon. But what's different about those situations is typically the next day or you know, in the coming days, they'll realize it was a vision. It was a, you could say, hallucination, or maybe it was just, you know, a figment of their imagination. They so wanted to see their loved one alive again that they kind of manufactured this vision. But in all those cases, they will come around and say, yeah, I realize that they weren't actually in the room with me. And again, there's situations like hallucinations. So people will claim, well, what if the disciples really did believe that they were that they saw the risen Jesus, but they were just hallucinating it? Well, the problem with that is that hallucinations occur in the mind. It's like a dream. You don't share a hallucination with your neighbor. And so when Jesus appears to a room full of these guys, which, by the way, it's not just Jesus, it's not just Paul talking about the 500 eyewitnesses. We have multiple corroborating eyewitnesses from the gospel author saying that Jesus actually appeared to groups. And for that to be the case, it couldn't have been a hallucination.
Mm-hmm. And for an extended period of time, because keep in mind, Jesus was with them for a period of days, not just a day, but several days. And they got the opportunity to talk with him, to walk with him, to touch him. All of those things, you know, which of course, a hallucination, you don't walk with, you don't talk with, you don't touch, certainly. And so you have that greater period of time as well, along with, you know, all of these eyewitness accounts, all these historic records, the recognition, Paul was martyred, Peter was martyred, we know James was martyred, and Jude is listed as having been martyred. We don't know how or when or what exactly, but at least in terms of historic record, he was considered to have been martyred, whatever that looks like. We don't know specifically. But all that to say, I mean, there is dramatic historic evidence. And, you know, one of the other ones you can really look at, I wrote a paper on this once, is the statement of the centurion who's there at the crucifixion of Jesus, and he ends up declaring Jesus to be the Son of God. If you're familiar with Roman history at all, that's a profound statement. In fact, he committed treason in that statement. If anybody else heard that statement, he's dead, for real. It's pretty profound. So it's like, no matter how you want to look at the truth of Jesus in, you know, any form or any way of looking at it. In fact, I would argue, you know, from a historian perspective, I mean, I don't know what really qualifies somebody as a historian, but I have a degree in history. So, you know, if that's what you're going to go by in terms of what constitutes a historian, or if you're a published author, again, I would classify as a historian. And yet, there are less evidence that we've gone off of to prove other things in history. In fact, a lot of things in history really come from one source. An example is the Constitutional Convention. We know a lot of what went on there, not because we have great record of what went on there. In fact, these were secret proceedings. Nobody was allowed in. There were no records kept. So how do we know what went on? Well, one guy by the name of James Madison wrote an account of what went on. And we basically, with the help of, you know, random pieces where other people journaled about, you know, this part or that part or the other part, or so we have a little bit of corroboration, but largely we have one eyewitness account, and from that we've created a big centerpiece of American history. The same is true when it comes to the Declaration of Independence. We have basically the written accounts from John Adams, from Thomas Jefferson, and from two or three other guys, along with, again, all those random little, this guy journaled about this part or wrote to his wife about that part, or, you know, that sort of thing. But again, no clear historic record. It was not reported by many, many people the same way. It's we've really just taken the word of one, two, maybe three people, and that's become our history. And we don't sit there and go, well, that's insufficient history. No, it's very sufficient, because those guys were literally in the room. They literally saw what happened. They literally saw the arguments that went down. And from that, we build out this historic record. What we're arguing here is this is not one guy. This is not two guys. This is not three guys. This is not even four guys. In fact, it's at least 500 and more, as we recognize, you know, the total number of people that wrote about this in the first century, wrote about it in the second century, wrote even about it in the third century. It's really that third century where these people were no longer the direct eyewitnesses, and they were no longer connected to the direct eyewitnesses. And yet, the historic record is dramatically profound as you look at the evidences and proofs of that. So, were we eyewitnesses of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus? No, Jason and I weren't. However, we have it on the greatest proofs, I would say, of any event in history, that it literally happened, it's literally true, and we can literally trust it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.